And let's go to the phone line here. We got Dr. Lauren C. Scott with Lauren Scott and Associates on the line with us here. He's down in Louisiana preparing for the annual forecast, and we're going to get to that in just a moment for the economic, for the state and all the different industries, and we'll let him explain that in a moment or two. But first, hurricane happening, obviously that's going to change some meetings that you're having, and it's going to do all kinds of different things. So how are you doing today, sir? And let's start with some hurricane talk.
Well, first of all, I'm happy to have power. There's several hundred thousand people down here, especially in South Louisiana, is in especially the area that services the offshore oil and gas industry, still does not have power after now 2 weeks. So, but it's being restored much quicker than people anticipated. And so we've got linemen from all over the United States down here trying to get this thing repaired. We had at one time 9 refineries that were shut down. You know, this is a very refinery-rich area that this of them were down. And the good news is that 6 are back up, and 3 of them are pretty close to restarting soon. So that will help keep us from having any kind of major shortage of gasoline, jet fuel.
What's happening in Lake Charles? You mentioned 9 refineries down. My mind went right away to Lake Charles, where not only do they have, you know, LNG plants, but they've got so many things on the books for construction. They've got plants that have probably really popped up in the last 6 to 9 months, and just they had so much positive momentum happening down there. What's an update from that?
Well, I mean, the good news is the hurricane did not hit them. The bad news is 2 of them hit Lake Charles last year, and Winter Storm Uri and a flood that they had there in May. So it's like the Moses came along and said, I'm going to start the plagues out here. And they just kind of kept coming for a while. And the other unusual thing about Lake Charles is that normally when you have natural catastrophes like this, federal aid starts showing up within 120 days or so. It's been a year now. It's been a year plus, and there's been no federal help coming in to help this community rebuild. And as a result, I think Lake Charles is probably the only city of its size in the United States that has fewer people employed today than it did in April of 20 when we had the entire shutdown. So it's been really tough over there. Now their industries are back up. Their refineries and the chemical plants are all back up. I think there was just a small outfit called BioLab that was caught on fire, had to be totally rebuilt. But all the others were up and running. And right now we are waiting on a final investment decision by Driftwood to build a new $17 billion LNG facility there in Lake Charles. And another one, Magnolia LNG, which is a smaller one, probably around $6 billion. But just think about that number for a $1 billion facility that might also pull the trigger this year. So there's some real positive things out there industrially. Their issue right now is getting, you know, their workers being able to work at these facilities. There's a lot of damage to housing, especially to apartment complexes and that sort of thing. It's really created a labor shortage issue, and the people there are pretty discouraged after what has happened and not getting any federal help.
What type of labor are you seeing pop up as we kind of transition into your annual report and some of the things that, you know, obviously go into an economy? You know, we're hearing, you know, new jobs that are either coming online or being popped up because of the COVID money that came through and new construction projects, et cetera. What's happening down in Louisiana that either, you know, people in oil and gas need to know as they go into their annual meetings, or people looking at transitioning into, you know, some sort of energy bridge that still, you know, keeps 1 foot in energy and another, you know, an ag or something like that. We're hearing a lot more, you know, a diversification of crossbreeding and et cetera. So talk to me a little bit about that, what the jobs are directing and what you're hearing in the boardrooms.
Well, what we're seeing here, first of all, is the LNG market is still very rich. Again, I'm anticipating a final investment decision, what we call FID, obviously, from Driftwood for theirs over in Lake Charles. I'm really expecting a second one from Venture Global down on near the mouth of the Mississippi River in a parish down here known as Plaquemines Parish, near the port of Plaquemine. So those are both, I think the Venture Global, again, is about $8.5 billion project, and the Driftwood is in the neighborhood of $17 billion. It's a very, very large project. So, A, you're going to get the construction activity from those, which are going to be quite huge. Secondly, you're going to get some pipelines being built. Each one of those want pipelines being built. In the case of Driftwood, Driftwood wants to control their own supply of natural gas. So what they're doing is they're buying up property in the Haynesville Shale and developing wells in the Haynesville Shale up in the northwest corner of Louisiana and the northeast corner of Texas. And they want to be able to control about 1.5 BCF of natural gas before they pull their trigger and build their plant. Right now they're at about 100 million. So 100 million, and they want 1.5 billion cubic feet. So they're ways along, but what that means is that's really good news for the Haynesville. And also what's happening is, if you look at the graph of what's happening to our exports of natural gas to Mexico, I mean, it is increasing dramatically, exponentially. There's now about 2.5 billion cubic feet going down into Mexico, mainly coming from the Permian Basin area, the Waha hub down there, which is kind of a new natural gas hub. And what is happening is Mexico is trying to convert all of its coal-fired plants into natural gas-fired plants, cleaner burning ones. And so there's just huge amounts of natural gas going that way. So the whole natural gas sector is, I think, poised for a good couple of years. And of course, by the way, one of the other side effects of the of Hurricane Ida is about, I don't know, about 77% of our offshore production is shut in still. And what is happening is that's creating a spike in the price of natural gas. And of course, if you're a natural gas exploration company, you're very, very happy about that. Matter of fact, if you're an oil exploration company, Jason, you get a lot of associated natural gas when you drill for oil. So that's a really nice market that is popping up there. And my guess is natural gas prices are going to stay in excess of $3 per million BTU going forward for the next couple of years.
I think the natural gas market is still going to be one of the ones that's going to be very difficult for anybody to realistically even transition away from, no matter how many goals and deadlines they put in there, just kind of the reality of it, especially when you're talking about some of the Mexican market there. And we know what's happening over in Europe, and they would do anything for cheaper natural gas. What's going on with Louisiana in terms of, you know, just the oil and gas world? You mentioned the Haynesville a little bit there, and they've been a player in this shale boom from the get-go. So give us an update and, what people need to know on that end of it.
Well, I mean, our only real profitable shale play is the Haynesville Shale in the northwestern part of the state, which is a dry play. You only get natural gas out of it. Our oil shale play, which is the Tuscaloosa marine shale down in the kind of the southern part of the state, kind of where you think of Louisiana being a boot, the part where you would tie your boot, kind of go across the state from east to west there. There's a massive oil shale play there. The problem is it's not in nice, neat rock like you've got up in the Bakken play there in North Dakota. It is a much clayier kind of play. So that when you drill it and you try to frack it, it tends to collapse more and not. It's just very expensive. I think they figured out how to harvest the oil out of it, but doing it is way more expensive than, say, doing it in the hard shales like you have in the Permian Basin, the Niobrara, and up there in the Bakken play in North Dakota. So we don't have very much going on there. Our big issue, our big thing that we're watching carefully is what's going on in the Gulf of Mexico. And of course, this there's a lot of oil, there's a lot of natural gas that is produced in the Gulf of Mexico. And about 90% of that activity in the Gulf of Mexico is serviced out of a port in Louisiana called the Port Fourchon, down in, right on the coast below Houma, Louisiana. And that is a port. I mean, the eye of the hurricane came right over there. They had 150-mile-an-hour winds whipping that place badly. Now, the good news is within a week, they're using generating power. They still don't have electric power now. They had generating power to get that place basically almost like a third operational now. And they've got all the debris out of the bayous the slips and the waterways that go into the port, so it's now navigable. That's good. That's happened much faster than people thought. But still, getting people out to the platforms and then getting the supplies that they need to operate out there is still a little bit in limbo, and that's why, again, only about 77% is there. Now, we've been, longer term, we've been very worried about this area, the Gulf of Mexico, because of Biden's policies. You know, Biden is surrounded by people who want to attack that area because it's public waters. Of course, he put a moratorium on lease sales out there, which a judge in Monroe, Louisiana, a federal judge in Monroe, Louisiana, overturned, pointing out that the schedule of lease sales is a prerogative of the legislature, not the executive branch. They couldn't just do that. So they are saying they're going to reschedule the lease sales now, but they haven't done that. And my guess is they probably won't have them until after the first year as they go through appeals, all this other stuff. But right now, absent Ida, absent the hurricane, the Gulf was pretty much continuing along, producing and drilling and developing more production on existing leases that they had out there. I don't know how much your listeners want to know about penguins, but you know, once the Department of Interior also controls the drilling permits. Once you have a lease, they have a drilling permit, and you'd think that, hey, that's the second place that the Biden administration would attack, would be just not issuing permits. But there is a rule that if you buy a lease, you basically got a contract with the federal government. The oil company has a contract with the federal government. The federal government cannot do something that would make that lease valueless. There are something called leasing rights that they have. And so they can't just quit giving out drilling permits. And by the way, drilling permits have continued to flow out of the Department of Interior despite being housed by a lot of people who don't like that area.
You know, I'm not up on my maritime law, but what's the mileage for offshore? Like, as far as how many miles offshore can you still claim Louisiana's economy and Texas? And then when does it start getting, you know, international, et cetera?
Yeah, it's right at 3 miles.
It is three, okay.
About 3 miles offshore, and then you get into waters that are controlled by the federal government, and it goes. Matter of fact, all of the Gulf of Mexico, none of it is what you'd call just international waters that are, you know, just free of any control of any country. If you go off of, I forgot the exact mileage, but you go off of our coast and go off of Mexico's coast, you know, given the international lines that they got, they actually overlap at one place. There's a little place up called the Donut Hole where both the United States and Mexico have control. And they've had some treaties that they've worked out on how to control activity in that area. It's mainly when you get to the East Coast and West Coast where you go offshore a certain distance and even the federal government doesn't control what happens out there. That goes into international waters. But all the Gulf of Mexico is covered by either Mexico or the United States.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I guess I was thinking more of the East and West Coast, but the Gulf of Mexico makes total sense. Gulfs make sense because there's
Yeah.
At least just one imaginary line you have to draw, I guess, to keep it in some boundaries, yeah, and et cetera.
Right, but, and that imaginary line, like I say, between Mexico and the United States has a donut hallway.
Right, exactly. Well, I imagine,
it's
but
really,
you know,
kind of weird. Well, a weird thing, but that's the way it is, you know.
Well, you know, that type of line, you know, wars would be fought over that, because that's
no,
there's a lot of dollars in those waters and underneath.
There's a whole lot of as a matter of fact, you know, those fields in the Gulf of Mexico, unlike, let's say, a Bakken play where you drill and you drill a well, you can drill a well very quickly. Of course, you can get a well drilled, you get the land. The land rights and drill the well in, what, 6 months or something like that. Out there, it's like a 7 to 10 year planning horizon just before you drill even the first well. And once you drill, though, unlike in a Bakken play where you might get, you know, 400 barrels a day in the first year and then it drops like a rock, in the Gulf of Mexico, when you get thousands of barrels a day. And it has a very shallow decline curve. That's why they're still out there and spending, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars building a platform and a drill ship to drill. Because once you hit one of those babies, I mean, it's a mother load. It's nice sand. You don't have to frack. It just comes shooting up. And it's just all you got to do is figure out how to drill in 2 mile deep water, which is... Well, I think the technology out there is more difficult than land a person on the moon, in my opinion.
Well, I think you're probably right. I mean, there's different pressures and all kinds of different things come into play, and absolutely. When is the report's not done yet that you're currently working on? Is it when's the availability, and what's the story behind that again?
It comes out. It'll be released October the 5th. We have a big meeting down here in Baton Rouge called the Top 100 Luncheon that the Business Reports magazine puts on, and that's our release. That's when we release it to the general public, and then I go around the state to, you know, basically all the major cities giving presentations on what's happening in their area.
And you guys have it on the website and everything like that too?
We will have the advertising on our website. This is a long document. It's about 150 pages long. Mainly because there's an appendix that has a history of each one of the 9 metropolitan areas in the state, plus economic history, plus the rural areas. So you got 10 areas where we do forecasts for them in the first half of the book. Second half of the book, if people are interested, there's an economic history going back to 1980. You can kind of figure out why Lafayette has behaved the way it's done over time, and which then kind of helps you understand why we'd come up with the particular forecast we come up with.
Well, and you know how it is. There's always one, maybe two people in each company that actually care about it, because that's their job. Because it's very long and very technical, and you got to enjoy the type of stuff. That's usually the person who's getting paid to do it, but there's usually one or two other people in the company that like to stay abreast of that type of thing, and et cetera. Sure. How about your other side gig? You know, how you make a living going around and being a speaker and all that good stuff. You know, COVID really put a hiccup and a bump in a lot of the you know, the speaking profession, and just those people that go to trade shows and, you know, make a living doing that. Are you doing the economic forecasting stuff, but are you getting out there in the circuit at all doing anything?
Some. I mean, again, COVID has been disastrous for conferences, which is one of the things I speak at. For example, last year alone, you know, New Orleans is our big convention city. It has the 6th largest convention center in the United States, as it turns out. They had 66 conventions canceled last year. They had 40, so far this year, they had in excess of 40 conventions canceled that were planned for the area. So there's been a few where people actually get together. I've spoken at a couple of those. Last week, I actually drove to Gulf Shores, Alabama, and they had a conference. They were going to have their conference there. They canceled it because of the COVID spike, especially the Delta variant thing. But they asked all the speakers to come over there, and they did a video. You know, we made our presentations into a camera instead of to the audience. But it was just as if the conference was taking place. And of course, other people are going, like I did one this weekend for a bank in Kentucky, of their directors. And that was totally done through Microsoft Teams or Zoom or some vehicle like that. So to the extent that it's going on more virtually now than in person.
Interesting. Yeah, the world's changing on that, for sure.
Yeah, speaking of medicine has really dropped off a lot, as it turns out.
Yeah, and in the conferences, too. I even noticed, you know, in the beginning of the summer, there was, a good spike in attendance. And then sometime after July 7th or 8th, it started it started having the Bakken curve. Just started going down pretty hard, you know. It's
Yeah, it was exactly like a decline curve in the Bakken oil.
It really was. I mean, honestly, after kind of that 4th of July, about 2 weeks after the 4th, I noticed a lot of the conferences, the some people were pulling out and just that sort of thing. And COVID and Delta was always what was cited. So, you know, that's just kind of the – I'm just trying to get a pulse on if this is the new normal or if this is just going to be one more year of a hiccup and et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, folks, there you go. Dr. Lauren Scott, he just gave you some anecdotal. We, of course, have talked about some anecdotal on the show, so everybody can make up their own minds going forward. But how can people give you some business, either virtually or, you know, via these economic reports? Because I imagine you've probably written a few white papers in your day, too.
Well, I do. And, of course, every year we put out the Louisiana Economic Outlook. And in the front end of that, we have a whole section on the oil and gas industry because this is the – but we're the number two producer of oil, the number six producer of natural gas in the United States. So, and we're the number two producer, two refinery capacity, number six in chemical production. So energy is vitally important to us. And so the front end of the report, always what we call the underlying assumptions part, always has a technical write-up on what's going on in the oil and gas, oil and natural gas industry too.
Of course, we'll have all the links and we'll also have your annual report on October 5th after it's available for the public and how people can get in contact with you. Any final words, thoughts as we let you get on your back to your day here?
No, I think that's all, Jason. It's always a treat talking with the folks, and I miss coming to North Dakota. It was always a great treat to come out there and give speaking engagements.